All right. Thank you, everyone. I think we'll make a start. Good morning. My name is Suresh Amirabadi, and I'll be chairing the session today on quantum computing. I'd just like to start off by introducing our presenters today. So we've got Anthony Lowe, non-executive director, business leader, and actuary, and Michael Walker, founder and operator of Shrocat Security. Welcome.
Thank you.
I think just one item before we start. So if you have any questions, please enter them through the app, and we'll ask the questions of the presenters at the end of the session in the Q&A section. All right, I'll hand over to you.
Thank you, Suresh. Can everyone hear? Yeah, okay. Just before we start, and I have to say it was Trevor Matthews who persuaded me to say this, I just wanted to remember Tim Jenkins, the older Tim Jenkins, not the superannuation Tim Jenkins. Those, a number of you know, I think, that he wrote a couple of papers in quantum mechanics, published articles. And because of that, I asked him if he would like to co-present this session with me before I met Michael. And he was lovely, always lovely, but he was lovely. But he said very presciently, look, I'll decline because I'm over 80 and I'm not in very good health. So anyway, there you go. So quantum computing is expected to revolutionize the way we think about data and computing from areas like the encryption that banks use, breaking the encryption that banks use for transactions across the internet, to vastly speeding up certain types of actuarial calculations, such as optimization problems of investment portfolios and things like that. But given how far away we are from working quantum computers, which most experts think is probably about 10 years, should we be worrying about it now or not? And we think the answer to that is yes, you should. We think there are opportunities for people who work out how it's going to work early. And there are certainly risks for organizations that don't think about post-quantum cryptography and what will happen when quantum computers come along. And I made a gag to Michael this morning. I said, of course, we don't know that the Chinese and the Russians don't already have quantum computers. They just haven't talked about it. And he said, well, there are people who say that that might well be the case. So there you go. So in this presentation, I guess we'd probably call it Introduction to Quantum Computers for Actuaries. We're going to talk about key concepts in quantum computing, superposition, entanglement, no cloning, things like that, how it works. We're going to discuss the various approaches and practical challenges to building a quantum computer. We're going to talk about quantum algorithms. We are going to talk about cybersecurity, and then we'll wrap up and take some questions. So, key concepts first. So I happily said at one point, as all actuaries know, classical computers use bits, which are one and zero. I then thought to myself, I wonder actually whether people just use computers and don't know that, but they do. So those are their bit values. And in quantum computing, its data is represented by qubits, which are quantum states that can have two values. And common examples of that are the electron, which can have spin minus a half or plus a half, and photons, particles of light, which can have vertical or horizontal polarization. And both of those are used in the various approaches, different approaches to building quantum computers. I probably should say that although it's a quantum property called spin, electrons don't actually spin. They have a magnetic moment which suggests that they're spinning, but if they really were, they'd have to spin faster than the speed of light. So it's actually just a quantum property. And qubit values are usually represented in this linear equation. So psi is alpha, the zero state, and beta, the one state, where alpha and beta are complex numbers. The modulus of alpha squared plus the modulus of beta squared is 1, and that's what's known as the superposition of the states. So in some sense, but only some sense, a qubit is simultaneously in the up and down state. And that's the same, actually, as the famous Schrödinger cat example that everyone knows about, where the cat in the box is in some sense simultaneously alive and simultaneously dead. But when you open the box or you take a measurement of a qubit, it will only give you the value zero with probability modulus of alpha squared, or the value one with a modulus of beta squared. So Schrödinger actually originally developed that thought experiment to prove that the standard interpretation of quantum mechanics was ludicrous. How can it be that the cat is simultaneously alive and dead? That doesn't make any sense. But it's now used to illustrate how quantum systems behave very differently than classical systems. And you can represent the state, the psi, as this sphere known as a Bloch sphere. And that little arrow there is the state, and it can be anywhere on that sphere. So in classical computing, it uses gates. They're manufactured on silicon chips, as I think everybody would know. The gates operate at millions of times a second, thousands of millions of times a second, and there are billions of these little gates on each chip. And they use Boolean operators, which I think actuaries would be familiar with, such as and or, and not. And some of those gates are irreversible. In other words, if you know that the output from an AND gate is 1, you know the two inputs were 1, both of them. But if the output's 0, you don't know whether it was 1-0 or 0-1 on the input. So, and what that means technically, and we'll come to it, is information is being destroyed, and that has implications. Whereas in quantum computers, all quantum mechanics use what's called unitary operators, and that's necessary to preserve the probability as 1 of the output states, and they're reversible. And there are various gates that you can use, the CNOT gate, the Hadamard gate, CCNOT. And just to give you an example, with a Hadamard gate, if you have a known down qubit that goes in, what comes out is a superposition which is equally up and down. And if you put a known up qubit in, then what comes out is also a superposition which is evenly up and down. But if you notice in the middle there, the top line has a plus and the bottom line has a minus. So the practical application when you measure the system is you'll get down half and up half of the time in both, but the phase, if you're familiar with phases in physics, the phase of the two states is actually different. So we've come to entanglement. So the best way I think to illustrate this is if you had a neutral spinless particle, say a neutral pion in the middle there at the top, and it were to decay into a positron and an electron, then to maintain the angular momentum, for conservation of angular momentum, one of those particles has to be up and the other one has to be down, so the total state has zero angular momentum like the original state had. But those two particles fly away from each other, so if you measure one of them, the other one must be in the opposite state, even if they're now too far away for a signal to have travelled between one particle and the other. And Einstein didn't like that at all. He said that he called it spooky action at a distance. And he argued that actually there must be hidden variables, i.e. variables we can't see, that actually determine which state both particle is going to be in. And they're carrying that as they fly away. And so you measure one and you get one answer, but it's already, the other one's already been determined what the answer's going to be. But unfortunately for Einstein, experiments have been done that show that that's actually not right. Entanglement is real. And what that means, if you look at the second line here, is that the state is actually a combination of alpha down and up and beta up and down. And what's actually going on is you can't decompose the tensor that's representing those states into an up and a down. It's an up-down and a down-up. And that's actually, from a mathematical point of view, what's going on here. And entanglement's important because it allows one qubit to effectively control another one, and that can be used to control which components are included in qubit states, and that can improve the efficiency of a quantum algorithm. So another important point about quantum computing is you can't make an independent identical copy of a qubit unless you know its state. So if you measured it was down, you can make another down one. If you measured it was up, you can make another up one. But if it's in this superposition, you can't copy it. And that puts limitations on what quantum algorithms, quantum circuits can do. It also has implications in error correction, which we might talk about a bit later. And another important point, because of this unitarity, no information can be destroyed. So the system, no information is lost until you measure the output of the system and you get an answer, when the state collapses into one or the other, and then all the other information that was in the system disappears. So how do quantum computers provide an advantage over classical computers? And I think it's important to make the point that they don't in all cases. There are certain types of problems that they improve enormously, like breaking the current encryption protocols used by banks, and other problems where they have a speed up, but not nearly as much. And then some problems where you're actually better off using classical computing, particularly because some of the problems that we'll talk about, the difficulty of loading data into the initial data load into a quantum system, and the limitations that puts on things. So classical bits are a naught or a one, as we said, whereas qubits are represented by the block sphere, as we can see here. So to mathematicians, that means that the state space of a qubit is vastly bigger than the state space of a bit. And what that allows is quantum computers to run algorithms that can't be run on classical computers efficiently. And some of those algorithms can be interpreted as quantum parallelism, but others aren't, but they still might be useful and speed up the calculation. So just talk a little bit about that. So in calculation theory, information theory, there's a concept of calculational complexity, which is the number of steps, or equivalently the time taken to complete a calculation. And if you can do a calculation in less than kn to the p steps, for every, where n's the input size for every p, then we call that calculation tractable by classical computers. And calculations that need more steps than that are said to be intractable. They could still be solved, but it might take to the end of the universe to get the answer. And what quantum computing has the power to do in certain types of calculations is exponentially speed all of that up, and therefore solve the problem, which is effectively not soluble in a classical computer. So the sort of actuarial calculations that are likely to benefit from quantum computing are optimization problems, those that involve sparse matrices, and combinatoric calculations. So I just wanted to give a little bit of historical context to all of this. So up there in the top left corner is the world's first electronic programmable computer, called Colossus. It was built in 1944 and installed at Bletchley Park. It uses thermionic valves. There weren't any kind of programming languages at that point. It used switches and patch wiring to program the computer. And as you can see by these two wrens operating it, it filled pretty much a whole room. Now we have a much more powerful computer in most of our pockets. And along the way, when the Americans sent the Apollo astronauts to the moon, they had a computer on board the Apollo spaceship. it was approximately as powerful as the HP12C that most of you have probably got in your pocket. So over that 80 years, we've just seen an enormous increase in computing power, complexity, development of programming languages, all those kind of things. Down here in the bottom left corner, that's Professor Michelle Simmons at the University of New South Wales and Silicon Quantum Computing. That's her quantum computer. As you can see, it occupies almost a whole room. So the question is, in 10, 20, 30, 80 years' time, where will we be with quantum computing? But my guess would be that we will see pretty much the same kind of transition that we see in classical computing. And with that, I'll hand over to Michael.
Okay, thank you, Anthony. So when we go to build a working quantum computer, there are some challenges that need to be overcome. And these basically derive from the fact that quantum state is very easily disturbed. So we can prepare it in the state that we that suits us. But even the slightest bit of thermal interaction with the outside environment can easily flip that state into something we don't want. And so we're going to lose the information that we put in, and we're going to bring in some information we didn't really want. So the qubits are not just interacting with each other, but with their environment. And this decoherence, as we call it, where they start to fall away from the state that was ideal, just builds up over time, and it gets worse with higher temperatures. And this is the reason that most quantum computing technologies being developed need to be kept at millikelvin or maybe a few Kelvin temperatures in order to work. It's just that the decoherence will kill them pretty quickly. Another flow on from that is that even though we will no doubt make improvements, and there are some technologies that can be run at room temperature, there's always going to be a certain amount of errors that take place. These errors, of course, take place in classical computing. The difference is that the transistors we use in a standard computer might make a mistake every billion, 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 billion operations, whereas with a quantum computer, the qubits struggle to hold their state for more than a few milliseconds, again, depending on the technology. So what people are developing now, and there's been good progress with this, is called error correction. And so what happens with error correction is that instead of just having the one physical qubit to operate as a qubit, you need a whole bunch of them. You basically make a little mini circuit of qubits, and one of those qubits is holding the value, that's holding the state, and the rest of them are just having interactions amongst each other and with the main one to keep it honest, so that if things flip when they shouldn't or rotate when they shouldn't, the rest of the circuit picks up on this and puts it right again. So there's been a lot of progress with that, and there will be more. But there will be a wall, I'm sure, and this is going to be a limit. And it's one of the reasons, as Anthony mentioned earlier, that the quantum computer is not going to beat the classical computer at everything. It will only really be good for certain specific tasks. So as I mentioned, there are multiple ways of doing it. There are different technologies. We've just got a list here. We've talked about Michelle Simmons' Silicon Quantum Computing Group. So they use the spin or the quantum dot approach. It's basically based in silicon, which is a nice advantage of this because we can then use the silicon technology that we have already and just manipulate it a little bit. So their approach puts phosphorus atoms in select places, and they provide the quantum properties that we need to be a qubit. Photonic quantum computing, we have light. It's basically light, usually either a right-handed or a left-handed polarization state, and they can interact. That requires non-linear materials to get the interactions we need, and they can be a bit slow, but they can operate at room temperature. I won't go through all of them in great detail. Trapped ions, you basically have an ion held in some sort of grid arrangement by lasers. Superconductors again, they have quantum properties. Adiabatic and annealing is a different approach. We're going to mainly focus on gate-based circuits in what we talk about. But the adiabatic approach, basically, you have your qubits set up and you impose a potential on them, and the minimal energy state under that potential correlates to the solution to the problem that you're trying to solve. The last one I'll go to in any detail, because I used to work in that field, was the NV diamond approach. So that's, you have a nitrogen impurity accompanied by an empty space inside an otherwise perfect diamond lattice. The approach of doing this is that diamond being hard can protect that qubit from the thermal effects and from environmental effects. So we can get a respectable lifetime for our qubits at room temperature and under ambient conditions. And in fact, the company that I used to work for, they had a quantum computer, albeit a very small one, working in the same room as a standard supercomputer, an HPC center, over at the Pawsey Institute. Those environments are very harsh. You've got electromagnetic fields, it's hot, you've got wind blowing everywhere, and they had these delicate qubits holding their states under those circumstances. So we need to be open-minded as to what sort of technology we're going to use. Anthony alluded to this briefly earlier. It's not convenient to load a lot of data onto a quantum computer. There's a lot of gates that need to be done. The gates are not particularly fast. And because we've got this decoherence problem that I mentioned earlier, you can't actually spend too much time uploading your data, because then you won't have enough time to process it. Now, there are clever ways around this, luckily for actuaries, because actuarial work, of course, depends a lot on data. It'd be nice if we could load our data up onto some sort of quantum RAM and then just read it from there when we were ready for it. People do work on this sort of thing, but that technology is a long way away. So for the foreseeable future, we won't be able to do that. So how do we go about handling this problem? Well, the basic principles are, first of all, do as much pre-processing classically as you can. And then when you go to upload things onto your quantum computer, make sure you only upload what you need. Don't just, modern computers, it's sort of tempting to say, oh, we'll just suck everything up onto it. But you don't have that luxury with a quantum computer, so you need to be a little more select. And there are compression techniques as well. So a quantum computer will run quantum algorithms if we want to take proper advantage of it. So we've given the two most famous examples here. They're by no means the only ones. The first one, First one is Shor's algorithm. This is really the one that got quantum computing started in a lot of ways. So it's useful for factoring co-primes. The quantum part of that algorithm actually does, if there are any number theorists among you, is solve the modulo period problem. But the solution to that can then be taken and used to easily find the primes of a co-prime. And this is the one that's going to cause us also a lot of cybersecurity issues in a few years' time. The other one here is called Grover's algorithm. So with Grover's algorithm, you may have generated a state in your quantum computer. It will be a superposition of many values, as Anthony has explained, and only one or two of those values is actually of any value to you. Now, if you just do the measurement in that state, then you've got a very small chance of getting the bit that was interesting. What we need to be able to do is to take that state and rotate it in its representation space so that it is pointing in the direction of the thing that we care about. So we basically magnify the component that's interesting, and the components that are not so interesting, we make their amplitude a lot smaller. So the basic way it works, we take these gates here, which will we haven't explained how these work, but this operation here will generate some complicated state. There's only one component there that we call it, that we care about, so that's sort of specified by the way that we've chosen to change the to interact with this. So what this particular gate is actually going to do, it's going to change the sign. So instead of being this component plus that component plus that component, it'll be this component minus this one plus that one plus that one. So the component we care about has its sign reversed, Now, a few operations have dropped off the end here, but basically what we then do is reflect that state of, over where it was originally. And we do that a few times, and we basically have then amplified the bit that we care about. What this part of the diagram here is showing is all the possible components that are in the state that we've generated here. 000, 001, 010, and so on. This one here corresponds to 101. So the reason that line there is pointing in the opposite direction compared to all the others is that's had a phase change. If you're not familiar with phases, just say that that opposite direction coincides to it having a negative sign instead of a positive sign. So those are the two most famous, but the ones that are probably more interesting from an actuarial point of view and just in terms of what's going to be needed to have quantum computers adopted broadly. Just a brief sampling, we've got Qubo, which is for solving binary operations that are unconstrained. Another important one is the quantum approximate optimization algorithm. So we'd use this one where it's too expensive, either classically or in a quantum approach, to solve the problem exactly. But by taking sufficiently more and more accurate and more detailed quantum circuits, we can approximate to increasing accuracy the solution that we need. And in a lot of practical applications, that'll get you close enough and do so faster and more efficiently than a classical approach might do. Partial differential equations, I only learned of this one quite recently. I was quite surprised by it, but there is an application out there that will solve partial differential equations 100 times more effectively than classical computers can do. I'm sure there are limits and constraints on that, but it's usable in principle. I'll mention this one briefly. I made a brief mention of that earlier, the quantum annealing. Again, that's not a gate-based circuit like the ones we showed on the previous slide. That depends on taking the qubits. You start them in a 0000 state. You gradually turn on an electric potential among them all, and you design that in such a way that the ground state that the qubits will describe once they've sort of finished reacting to it gives you the solution to the problem that you wanted to solve. HHL is for solving sparse linear equations, so that's obviously important. It's only good for sparse approaches at the moment. And it'll find you, your eigenvector will find the solution to your linear equation. In fact, it'll find all of the solutions. But when you take the measurement, when you do that readout at the end, there's no way of controlling which one you're going to get unless you do something clever afterwards, like a Grover's circuit or something. For some applications, that's okay. You might just say, I need a solution to this system, and you don't care which one it is. Or you just run it over and over and over, and you may get some repetitions, but you'll get there eventually. Or you may just plug it into another algorithm that comes after it to process it further. But these options are there. The one I know the most about, and one that's probably causing the most excitement at the moment, is the quantum machine learning. So pretty much every classical machine learning approach that's out there at the moment, except the most complicated, has some sort of quantum equivalent. Certainly the quantum neural networks are a very important field of research right now. Also, quantum reinforcement learning's got a lot of people working on it. And this approach was taken partly out of curiosity, partly out of the expectation that it would be faster, because that's what people think of with quantum computing. And what the results seem to be showing is that it's not faster, but you get better or same or better accuracy with fewer data samples. So if your sample space is maybe a bit small, then that would be an advantage. Another advantage that seems to have emerged is that the output of your model, once you've trained it, is more stable. So it's a lot of classical neural networks. You've got it trained and it works great, but then you just sort of fudge the input a little bit. You know, somebody puts a sticker over the stop sign on your self-driving car, and it can really throw them off under some circumstances. The quantum machine learning approach is less vulnerable to that. So a lot of people in this field think that we'll be taking a hybrid approach in the future. Another interesting possible advantage or partial advantage is energy efficiency. Now, classical computers, however well we design them, however small we make their chips, there are always some lower bounds on the amount of energy that they're going to consume. And a lot of that traces back to the use of lossy gates. Oops, sorry, I keep doing that. Yeah, so we're using AND and OR, and it's a thermodynamic result, and it's basic physics, that if you're overriding some information in some way, then there's going to be heat released. And there's a calculable minimum to that. It's basically proportional to the temperature you're operating at. So that's however efficient you may make it. Otherwise, unless you take great care not to delete anything or override or use lossy gates, you're always going to be giving off a certain amount of heat. It can be quite a lot too. The air conditioning in HPC centers is quite serious. Quantum computing doesn't have that problem. The reason being that the gates in a quantum computer are inherently lossless. They need to be. That's a constraint placed on us by quantum mechanics. So until we do our readout and our final measurement, there is no loss from that effect. The counter argument to that, of course, is that a lot of technology needs to be kept super cold, and that requires a lot of energy to do that. There are technologies that don't need that, and I'm sure we'll get very good at keeping it cold in the future, but there is that constraint as well, so it goes a bit both ways. Where we can really hope to come out ahead is algorithmic efficiency. So if the quantum computer is doing something in a few hours that a classical computer would take weeks or even months to do, then that's a lot of energy you haven't spent there. The infrastructure can be a lot less. Well, people often don't realize the infrastructure demands of a standard high-performance computing center. That's actually quite intensive. And optimization problems often work better on a quantum computer as well, at least in principle. So this is probably the final topic that I'll go into, and arguably the most important, and this is the danger that we face to our cybersecurity. So even if your company decides that the quantum algorithms aren't going to help them, you do still need to pay attention to quantum computing for this reason. The Shor's algorithm that I presented earlier, as we've said, is very efficient at factoring coprimes. So it'll scale in a linear scale, whereas the classical approach, any classical approach will scale exponentially. So that's a really big speed up. That's quite significant. So almost a lot of the transactions that we have over the internet and that we have keeping our data and our interactions secure, that's based on something called public key encryption, also known as asymmetric key encryption. The security of that encryption depends on the difficulty of factoring a large coprime. So once we have a quantum computer, that's not going to be hard anymore. Now, the other encryption methods, like symmetric key and hash-based and so on, they can still be attacked, but not with this sort of exponential speed-up that we're getting here. So there is some danger, but it's not nearly as bad. I was pleased earlier today. I met someone who asked me, what's to stop people downloading stuff now and hacking into it later when we do have a quantum computer? And the answer is nothing. It's already happening. Malicious hackers, usually with rogue states behind them, are known to be doing this. So this is what makes things urgent, not just that it's hard and time-consuming to make a transition, but because we are already being compromised. Yes. Oh, no? Never mind. The good news is, oh, yes.
What do you mean by rogue state?
Well, the Chinese, we're very concerned about what the Chinese Communist Party gets up to a lot of the time. I think Iran is often suspected of states that have few qualms about eavesdropping on other government's data or private data.
In the interest of time, I think we should keep going and then we can ask questions.
I mean, with respect.
Yeah.
I think we'll do
the questions after the session. Thank you.
I am nearly finished. So the good news is that there are solutions to this. We have new encryption methods that can basically replace the ones that we have now, especially the public key encryption. I won't go into the details of them. The module lattice key encapsulation mechanism and digital signature algorithm. There was a call from the National Institute of Standards and Technology for people to submit new approaches. They were then tested thoroughly. Most were eliminated. A few have survived. These three had standards released for them last August, and there is now a deadline in Australia for 2030, America for 2035. Falcon will have a standard released very soon, and there are others coming. So what I actually do at Shrekat Security is advise people on this and help them map a roadmap from the standard encryption that most people have now to encryption that incorporates these where it's appropriate. So, final slide. Commercially useful quantum computers are not quite here yet, but when they come, they will have a lot to offer, especially in terms of optimization. So organizations which sort of get ahead of that curve will be able to take advantage of it. A lot of quantum computing approaches require cryogenic cooling, and for that reason, a lot of them are kept in supercooled warehouses as you use them over the cloud. There are some field deployable approaches, such as the NV centers I mentioned earlier, and neutral atom technology as well. So when an organization looks at this problem, they need to think, what are our needs? Do we need a big thing? Do we need something on site, especially if speed or security is important, and need to make their choices based on that? So I thank you all for your attention, and we'll take any questions now.
Thank you very much. We don't have any questions from the audience yet. If you have any questions, please enter it into your app in the Q&A section.
Or they could stand at the mic and just ask if they want.
Yep, you could do that as well.
The mic is on.
I did have a question for you myself, though. As actuaries, what are some things that we could do to prepare for a post-quantum era? Are there any sort of quantum-inspired tools or algorithms that we could sort of play around with right now?
Yes, so there are some good simulation methods out there that you could run circuits on. Some companies like IBM have quantum computers available that you can sign up for an account and you can play on an actual real quantum computer.
Just an example, Michael and I are on a team, which includes Ramona Merrick, for a global quantum computing challenge, which has been set because this is 100 years since the introduction of quantum mechanics in 1925. And the challenge that we're addressing has been set by the World Bank. And what we're trying to see is, how can quantum computing help in providing parametric insurance for drought risk in Indonesia? So you can be working on those sorts of things right here, right now.
That's great. Really interesting. Any questions from the audience?
Do you recommend any resources to continue our education?
There are some very good resources available on the internet. Q-Control has a really good education package. You can sign up for that, and they'll run courses that will take you from zero to actually understanding things like quantum error correction in a certain amount of detail. And if you go for the higher price packages, which I haven't looked at, you get access to, I think, to things like certainly a simulator that you could run things on, and possibly access to a real one, but I can't swear to that one. Yeah, but the resources are not hard to find if you do have your Google search.
Yep. Sorry, we
got. Oh, maybe just hand.
Thank you. Thank you. That's really interesting. Not that I could follow all of it, but maybe a little bit. It sounds from what you're saying that quantum computers are the way of the future. How certain are you of that?
I'm quite certain that they are going to be part. They're not going to take over everything. They're not going to do everything. But your system will probably be some sort of hybrid where you'd run things on a conventional CPU, but it would upload certain routines or algorithms to the quantum computer or to a quantum processing unit. It's very similar, I think, to a GPU. GPU is great if you want to parallelize something, but not all tasks can be run in parallel, so you wouldn't use a GPU for those. Okay. Yes.
Could Shor's algorithm crack RSA? And if we were to move to some of the other systems you mentioned for, say, banking transactions, passwords, would they remain impenetrable for a long time, or would quantum computing eventually break those as well?
So to answer your first question, yes, it can break RSA. Well, not yet, but once they get big enough. And that is precisely why we had to go looking for these post-quantum alternatives, because it's based on prime numbers, and you don't get the exponential scaling advantage that we've been enjoying up until now. So if we move over to the post-quantum encryption method, there is no way quantum algorithm that will break them that we know of. Now, the current encryptions we have, they're not provably secure, but we've been at it for a few decades now, and we feel pretty confident about them prior to quantum. The quantum algorithms, or the quantum encryptions that we're bringing in, they've been really thoroughly tested hard, but it's only been 8 years, and hasn't been the whole world having a go at it. So we're quite confident that they won't be broken anytime soon, but logically we can't actually eliminate that. And so people who work in this space will speak of something called crypto agility. So when you bring in your new encryption, well, it's not a simple matter of swapping in and out anyway, but it needs to be done ideally in such a way that if, heaven forbid, these encryption methods are broken in the future, you'll be able to swap that out and swap in a better method when the time comes.
Thank you very much. I think that brings the session to a wrap. Can you all please join me in thanking Anthony and Michael for the presentation?
Thank you, everyone.